Okay.
All right. Is this thing on? Should I put it closer? I don't know. Okay. I'm Harlan. I'm a compulsive overeater. And I currently live in Scottsdale, Arizona. So we've got three Arizona people here, which is interesting. Good. Came to this disease very naturally. My mother and father were compulsive overeaters. Does that mean I was destined to be one? Probably not, because this is either something you have or you don't. But my mother was not aware that she was pregnant. My mother was mentally ill, and my mother had three very distinct personalities. My mother could be a screaming, raving lunatic at 8:05, and at 8:06 she could be a three-year-old. And at 8:07, she could be probably the most together lady you've ever known in your life. And if you had a discussion with her about current events or history or anything like that, she was right there. But you never knew what you were going to get. My father was 54 years old on the day that I was born. My father, pre-World War II, pre-Holocaust, around the turn of the century, came out of the murder and mayhem from Russia, or what is now the Ukraine, when Europe was a graveyard for Jews. And he was the sole survivor of a family of approximately 40 people. His brothers and sisters, his parents, his grandparents on both sides, aunts and uncles, cousins, his nieces and nephews under the age of 5 were obliterated off the face of the earth. And he was the sole survivor. And he came to this country very ill-equipped. He didn't speak the language. As a matter of fact, he had a very strong resentment against having to speak the language. He did not know the customs, and he wasn't educated here. His education stopped when he came here, which is when he was 14 years old. So he really was not equipped to do much. By the time I was about 2 or 3 years old, my weight and the amount of food that I was eating became a very, very serious topic of discussion amongst my mother, father, and the people that they were friends with. People who do not know this illness, people who do not understand this illness, would ask questions that have no basis in reality. Questions like, how could he possibly be hungry? We just ate. Well, what they don't understand is that the eating of food has absolutely nothing to do with hunger. It has absolutely nothing to do with hunger, because it is a hole in the soul that I could not understand, but that my brain and body were wired differently from the people that asked those sort of questions. And even though I didn't know how to express it, and even though I didn't know how to talk to them about it, even though I didn't know how to explain this to them, I understood from the time I was about 4 years old that you either understood this or you do not. You either get this or you do not. And the people who don't get it will never get it. Bill Wilson said later in his life, he said, to those who understand, no explanation is necessary. To those who do not understand, no explanation is plausible. And my mother and father would become very upset with people who would yell at them like that. And what would happen with some of these immigrants, my father was an immigrant, as I just told you, is they would pick up and form what was called cousins clubs. They weren't really cousins, but they picked up the pieces of the massacres, and they made families. They made families. And that's where a lot of this yelling would occur. And when I got to be about 5, 6 years old, they started yelling directly at me. And what I learned to do very effectively is shut down emotionally. I would just shut down to where you could yell at me and scream at me. And unless you were hitting me, which some people did, but unless you were hitting me, I could just weather the storm. And there was something that I didn't know how to explain to people. And what I wanted to explain to them is this, that there is nothing in this world, nothing in this world I want more than to acquiesce to your demands. To acquiesce to your demands of me eating less and weighing less is the second most strong thing I would like to do today. Except for eating more cookies. Because the minute you get away from me and you're making me cry and you're making me pee in my pants and you're embarrassing me and you're making me out to be the butt of jokes, and you're calling negative attention to me, and I'm 6 years old, and you're scaring me, that I would love nothing more than to be the thin person that you want me to be. I would like nothing more than to be that little boy who could run as fast as the other little boys, who could jump as high as the other little boys, who could ride my bike as fast as the other little boys. There's nothing I want more than that except to eat another fudgicle. And the minute I get away from you, that's exactly what I'm going to do, because I'm 6 and I don't know how to work step 10, and I don't know how to make this embarrassment. I don't know how to make this fear. I don't know how to make this anger go away any other way. What did I just do? Okay. And I'm 6 years old and I'm shutting down emotionally. And then when I got to be about 10 years old, and my weight is becoming a much more serious issue, I was traipsed off to the doctor. When you're 10 years old, you're in third grade, is that correct? 5 is kindergarten, first grade is 6, 7 is second grade, no, 8 is third grade. I think I was in third grade or fourth grade when this occurred, and I was given massive amounts of amphetamine 3 times a day. Now, how do I know that they were 500 milligrams of amphetamine 3 times a day? Because of all the things that I lost that I would love to have back, and I've moved around and I've moved cross country a couple of times, not long after I was divorced 4 years ago, not long after I was divorced, I found a bottle in my junk of this prescription from all those years ago from Dr. Jacobson. And I remember him screaming at my mother in Yiddish, and my mother was screaming at him in Yiddish, and all of a sudden I'm on these pills. Now, those pills work. Whoa, do they work? You sleep about 15 minutes a month. And I get accused of this now, but you like say the same thing 150 times, and you're in your head saying, why am I saying this again? Why am I saying this again? Why am I saying this again? But you can't stop yourself from saying it again about another 14, 15 times. And then you, in your temples of your head, you feel them going ba-ba-boom, 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 ba-ba-boom. And when the teacher is talking to you or anybody is talking to you, it just sounds like Charlie Brown's teacher. Quonk, 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 quonk. You're not hearing anything they're saying because they can't possibly talk fast enough for your brain to absorb the information. And I lost weight. And then about a year later, Kennedy was killed 63, this would be 64, summer of 64. But the medical profession starts getting some information on these amphetamines. So they changed it from a pink pill to a blue pill. And instead of taking it 3 times a day, I took it 4 times a day. Same exact effect. Now, I am an eater. I am not a fighter. I am not a violent person. I'm getting in fights at school. My grades are like terrible grades. I'm just a mess, but I'm not eating, because you see that even when I was a child, the people who do not understand see a symptom, and the symptom is Harlan is overweight. And so they take the symptom of my obese condition and they treat the symptom with the only thing that makes sense to them, and that is they see that I'm overweight, so they force me to reduce the amount of food going into my body, thus reducing the weight and solving the problem. But if reducing my weight solved the problem, you wouldn't be here and neither would I. Is there anybody in this room that has never lost weight? Everyone in this room has tried to diet and they've lost weight very successfully. But if losing weight through this form of dieting were effective, then hospitals would turn out winners, and they don't. And treatment centers would turn out winners, and they don't. And jails would turn out winners, and they don't. And locking people in a dungeon would turn out winners, and they don't. because the weight and the food are only symptoms of an illness that we're going to discuss a little later tonight, and we're going to be discussing all day tomorrow, and we're going to discuss Sunday morning until we leave. And we're going to get down to the nature of what this is so we can see not only the problem, but we're going to examine the solution. We're not going to sit here and tell you you should eat broccoli instead of Kit Kat bars. Is there anybody in the room that is unclear that Kit Kat bars are not as good a snack choice or a meal choice with your food than broccoli? Is there anybody unclear on that? If there is, see John after the meeting in the blue shirt. Okay. So now I'm getting into my teenage years, I'm getting into my double-digit years, and I'm having crushes on girls, and of course I'm the fattest kid in the school. And from the very earliest times on, I never saw that love, I never saw that sex, I never saw that girls would ever be interested in me. And I don't know that it was from the fat, I don't know that this has anything to do with it, but my mother and father, I never even saw them be nice to one another. I figured for sure they got me at Sears. For sure they got me at Sears. But the bottom line is, I never even saw them be nice to one another, let alone affectionate or even courteous to one another. But I never saw, and it says we're going to examine tonight when we do the doctor's opinion, we're going to see that Dr. Silkworth says we lose confidence. Of course I lost confidence in my life. Of course I lost confidence, because everything I tried to do to deal with the number one issue in my life failed. And my mother and father lived in a veritable battleground. My home was a battleground all the time. My mother and father showed their affection for one another with pots and pans flying through the air and lit cigarettes and curses flying through the air. Is that why I'm a compulsive overeater? No. But it was part of my reality. It was part of my reality. And I was a kid who had crushes, and I was a kid who had feelings, but I couldn't dare express them because of my overweight condition, or so I thought. Maybe I was wrong. I don't think so. But I wanted to wear Levi's like the other kids, and I wanted to wear Madras shirts like the other kids, and I wanted to wear Trimster pants like the other kids. And if you're from Chicago and you know the North Side, I wanted to buy my clothes at Mr. Junior's, which is where all the cool kids bought their clothes. I was wearing clothes that went out of style during the Great Depression. My father would take me down to Albany Park, the old Jewish neighborhood there, and if it fit me and it covered me and we could afford it, I wore it. And there were years of my life where I was wearing clothes that went out of style before the start of World War II. And there were times when I had three or four pairs of pants that fit me, and they were all exactly the same color, all exactly the same style, so it looked like I was wearing the same pants like every day for a long, long period of time. And it was really tough to be a teenager in that fat body, and I was 335 pounds by the time I was a senior in high school. And it was tough. It was really, really tough. Now, when I started to get into my college years, when I started to get into the years of senior in high school, junior in high school, when kids started going away to college, I somehow knew that these goals, these beautiful things that are a part of life, were not meant for me. I felt very excluded by those things. I felt very walled off from those things because I wasn't thin, and I didn't deserve anything like that. And I was dealing with a lot of stuff as a kid that it was a little hard for me to deal with. Because you see, from the time I was about 3 years old, I became my mother's husband and my father's wife. They never communicated with each other. They only communicated through me. And my mother would come home all the time, or she would say to me all the time, "I hate your father. The only reason I live here is because of you." And my father would come home from his sausage route and say, "I hate your mother. The only reason I live here is because of you." And truthfully, the only thing I wanted to know at that time was, is Huckleberry Hound going to get away from powerful Pierre? Or is Yogi and Boo Boo going to get the picture? picnic basket before Ranger Smith comes around the corner. That's all I really wanted to know. I was ill-equipped for this. And I was hearing every single day of my life from my well-intentioned, loving father, when they came to kill me, I got away. One day they will come to kill you. They're going to kill us all. And if they don't kill you, they'll kill your children. And this was the reality that he grew up in. And so he was trying to prepare me to be strong in the face of that reality. But all he was doing was scaring the living daylights out of me, because I assumed this impending doom. And when Ruby killed Oswald, he was absolutely sure, this is it. They're going to kill us now. That's the end of it. That's it. We're dead now. So I'm growing up in this, and I was dealing with things as a teenager that were very overwhelming for me. And don't we all deal with things as teenagers that are overwhelming? But one of the things I was dealing with was the failing health of my aged, mentally ill parents. My mother's greatest ambition in life was to become an invalid and die. She was diabetic. In 1976, when I was a senior in college, I graduated high school in 72. When I was a senior, junior in college, she went on dialysis. And that was the early days, 1976, when it was very different than it is today. And those shunts used to get infected like crazy. And it was terrible. My mother became an amputee from diabetes. And in July of 1976, when I was 22 years old, my mother finally passed away. She passed away from this illness. She passed away from her morbid obesity. And at the time she died, we were about 1,100 pounds between three adults. I was about 550 at that time, and my mother was about 270. My dad was about 270, and I was about 550 pounds, 600 pounds at that time. And my mother died in 1976. Now, the very last coherent conversation that I had with my mother was this. And I told you that my mother had three distinct personalities. This was her lucid personality. The last conversation I had with my mother was this. She said to me, "Harlan, my son." My son means my son. She said, "I saw so much good in you when you were a little boy." She said, "Please, my son, find a way to stop eating so much food so you don't have to be so fat. Find a way to lose the weight. Find a way." And these were her words, and she didn't know about step one, not to be a slave to the food. And that's exactly what I was a slave to the food. And in 1978, a year after I graduated college, my father passed away of cancer. My father was a very heavy smoker, and I was dealing with oncologists and dealing with things from the time I was 17, 18 years old. And my father was, as I said, a smoker, and when I was 24 years old, he passed away. The very last conversation that I had with my father went something like this. He said, "My son, I saw so much in you. I saw so much promise in you. And you're an American." See, my father's greatest thing that he said over and over to me was, "I survived so you could be born in this country." And he said to me, "Being born in this country is the greatest thing a human being can be blessed with, is to be born in this country, America." And he said, "Please, though, I thought maybe one day you could be president of the United States." And he said, "I love you so much," which I knew. He said, find a way not to eat so much. He said to me, he said, the fressen is an unglück auf der Welt, which means the overeating. To s means to eat, but the fress means to overeat in Yiddish. And he said to me, the fressen is of an Balachowska. The Balachowskas were the ones that rounded you up so you could be killed more efficiently. And he'd say that the food was your Balachowska. It came and it took you from us so you could be killed by the food. He'd say to me, "Find a way not to eat so much." And my father died in November of 1978, and my mother died in July of 76. Now, I don't have I don't have brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins. I don't have any of that stuff. I'm an only child. I do not have any kind of support like that at all. But you can believe what you want to believe, but I'll tell you what I believe in my heart. And I believe that my father went right to heaven because he lived hell on earth. He could be walking down the street and hear something. He could be walking down the street and smell something. He could be walking down the street and he was right back in the murder and the mayhem. And I know that he went right to heaven. And I know that my mother's mental illness probably qualified her for heaven too, because she lived a hell on earth too. I wanted Rob and Laura Petrie for parents, but I got Max and Virginia Grabowski. Because I think that my father and mother must have pulled some weight with God upstairs, God Almighty, because they were both gone by November of 1978, and in February, on February 2nd, 1979, two friends pushed their way past the filth and the squalor of my filthy, dirty, stinking apartment on Albany Street, which I couldn't pay the rent in. And they pushed their way past the garbage, and they pushed their way past the filth that I was living in. And I was lying when the truth would have served me better. I was tens of thousands of dollars in debt to friends who I had written bad checks to their parents. I had written bad checks to them. You know, during the 1970s, my food habit, not my cocaine habit, not my heroin habit, my hooker habit, or my gambling habit, my food habit was about $100 to $150 a day, and it never took a day off. I was writing bad checks to anyone dumb enough to cash them. I was lying when the truth would have served me better, and I was living in hell. And they brought me to my very first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous in 1979. And I heard some things and I saw some things, but I really didn't want to be there. They kind of forced me into going because I owed them money, and they were kind enough and wonderful enough to force me to go to these meetings. And I was not a fireball of willingness, let me tell you. I would eat my way to the meeting. I would pray for a Russian airstrike during the meeting, and I would eat my way home. But I heard a few things that did make sense to me at the time, and I was very glad to at least get a glimmer that there were other people that understood. And when I walked into those rooms, I was 24 years old. And I was 20, 30 years younger than anybody in those rooms. And I was 300-400 pounds fatter than any two of them put together. And I had a very opposite kind of effect. I had a very opposite sort of impression, not effect. Impression, a lot of you came into the rooms and you said, I'm well, but they're sick. I came into the rooms and said, I'm sick, but they're well. Because I looked around those rooms. Now, I'm at a men's retreat here in Santa Barbara, California, as we're here tonight, if you're listening on tape. But I walked into a room of mostly women, and they were beautiful, and they had rings and dresses and Cadillacs and Mercedes and Lincoln Continentals. And I said to myself, I said, self, what the hell are these women doing here? They look gorgeous, and they've kissed boys, and the boys had kissed girls. I couldn't figure out what these people were doing there. I really couldn't. But little by little by little, I understood some things that would open up a chasm to me, but it wasn't to be until later, because by 1981, 1982, I had graduated OA, and I went to a beautiful graduation ceremony that many of you have attended, although it wasn't mine, it was yours. And they said the same thing at mine that they said at yours. Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please? And that's what I heard at my graduation ceremony, and you probably did too at yours. And it wasn't for a few years that I was to come back. But on the way to coming back, I was to be hospitalized. And I'll tell you this just quickly. I'm trying to condense this for time. But the bottom, because I want to cover the doctor's opinion tonight. But the bottom line is still this. I was in that hospital, in Skokie Valley Hospital, because I had cellulitis and staph infection that was rampant through my lower extremities. And I can show you, if you give me a quarter, I'll show you the discoloration that I have in the back of my legs even today. Because you don't have to be 600 pounds to understand that life for the obese person slips away in a very horrific, nightmarish fashion. I could not go to a movie because I couldn't fit in the seat. I broke car furniture, car interiors. I broke chairs. I broke couches. I broke a dentist's chair. I broke beds. Every bed that I slept on was broken. They would snap as I would just plop my big can on the bed, and they would snap and it would hurt my back because my bed was always broken. I couldn't wipe my own ass without a wall to lean against. I could be in the shower for 2 hours and not be wet. You could dry me off for a year and I wouldn't be dry. There were pockets of flab that I would shove towels between the layers of flab to keep the skin from rubbing together to get that contact dermatitis, that angry skin, that red angry skin. And let me tell you, there is no pain like that. It's almost akin to the pain of shingles, but not quite as horrific. It was unbelievable that I was survived. What I smelled like from the towels and the rubbing was unbelievable. I pissed and shit in my pants all the time. I was incontinent. I could not control the piss from going into the towels. I could not control either end. And the only thing that I knew to do to put out the fire of that eating, of that situation, was more eating. So the very thing I didn't want to be doing, I was doing constantly, because I didn't know what I know today about the nature of this illness. And I stand here today as a miracle. And I have a friend, his name is Roy L. You call him on the phone or you see him, you say, "How are you?" He'll say, "I'm a miracle of mental health," because it says in the big book, it says, "We who have recovered are miracles of mental health." And that's what he'll always say. So I guess I'm a miracle of mental health too, although I'm not quite so sure. But the bottom line is that I stand here today as a miracle. Because I went into the hospital in 1982, into Skokie Valley Hospital. I had cellulitis and staph infection. You see, I didn't have hair on my legs like I do today, because the swelling was so profuse that you can even see today I have the edema still. The edema is the swelling, and you can see a mark where my sock is because I've been on my feet a lot more than I normally am. But when I lay down, it goes away. But I had that edema, and it was so bad. The pus was running out of the back of my legs. I had diamond penny size ulcers in the back of my legs where the pus would run out. What I smelled like was unbelievable. I went into the hospital with 104 fever. It was April of 82, 83. Harold Washington was just elected mayor when I was in the hospital. I think that was 83. Harold Washington, 83? You guys don't know. Okay, it doesn't matter. Harold Washington, first black mayor of Chicago? Okay, nobody knows? Okay, it doesn't matter. Okay. Okay, so I'm in the hospital, and I'm 513 pounds, and I have 104 fever, and they say if it gets to 108, we'll think of you fondly. Have a good trip, because you're dead. And I had a weight, and they gave me this blue, like the blue gown, and it looked like a tie. And I had a set of knockers in those days. Most women would have paid 50 grand. You talk about knockers that can pick up a six-pack? I had knockers that could pick up a Buick. I had knockers that could pick up a Buick, baby. And I'm sitting there, and this tie is on me, and I had to wait for the guy for the shop to come up. And he had to make sure that, because all hospital beds are on wheels, and he had to secure the bed because they were literally afraid that I would just crash right into the wall and hurt myself or hurt the equipment. Maybe I'd roll out onto Skokie Boulevard. That'd be funny. But anyway, not really. But the bottom line is I also had to wait for the guy to come up from the OB-GYN ward, because they had to put my legs up in stirrups so that the swelling would go down. and I had cellulitis and staph infection rampant through my system. And they were trying different things. And I went in, it was a Monday, and I know on Tuesday night, the nurse came in and she said 99. And I sat on that bed and I cried because I thought they were going to have to amputate my leg. They were suspicious it had gangrene, and they didn't know if the other leg had gangrene. And the cellulitis and staph were getting beaten back, and my temperature went down to 99. And I was in that hospital for 15 days. You know how sick you have to be in a hospital for 15 days, even then? You know how ill you have to be for 15 days? And when you're in there and they do your chart and they put things on your chart and they leave it on the foot of your bed, and my friends came in and showed me that it said 513 pounds, and it said, this is not a mistake, this man is huge. They didn't want somebody from a lab picking up the 513 pounds and thinking that this is a mistake. No, it was no mistake. And they come, and when you have morbid obesity and you have insurance as part of the situation, it's like wrote into the system, they send up the psychologist, the psychiatrist, the nutritionist. And the first one they send up is the nutritionist. And this was a very learned, studious person. She weighed, I think, 81 pounds. And she came up to my room and she imparted some sage wisdom on me. She said, don't eat dessert. And I said, where have you been all my life? Where have you been my whole life, baby? Where have you been? And then the doctor told me that whatever you're served, just eat half and don't eat potato chips and don't drink pop. And I thought, you're a genius. I mean, you guys really, I mean, you're on the ball here. And then up comes the psychologist, the psychiatrist, and they imparted. Now, this gal weighed about 94 pounds. She had a clipboard so she didn't fly away. Remember The Flying Nun? Are you old enough to remember that show? A good stiff Chicago wind had come and she'd be gone. So she comes up and she told me to put a picture of something I really wanted, like a goal or something, on the refrigerator so that when I see the picture, I won't eat so much. I says, you are a genius. I says, man, whatever they're teaching you over there at Northwestern, you are a flipping genius. And I walked out of that hospital after all the crying and all the singing of our national anthem that I did. And our national anthem was sung 5,000 times a day in my room. God, get me out of this one. I'll never eat like this again. God, get me out of this one. I'll never eat like this again. And I walked out of that hospital in April of 1983. And there was, and one of the most beautiful, horrible side effects of morbid obesity is the dry skin, and you get those fissures at the bottom of your feet, and you feel like you're walking on glass. If you haven't had those, I hope you never get them. And I walked out and I couldn't wear socks, and real cold air doesn't hold any humidity. I couldn't wear socks because they would dig into me, and I couldn't get them on, I couldn't get them off because they'd get soaked from the pus. And I walked out and there was about an inch of ice in that parking lot. If you've never been to Chicago in April, let me tell you, here's the experience. You will frequently use your heater and your air conditioner on the same day. If you've never experienced this, you're not from Chicago. Okay. And I walked out and I turned on the car and I didn't know if it was going to start. And it started. And I thank God from the bottom of my heart for what He had given me. And to show my appreciation to God, I had a 10 and 2 fives in my wallet. I can see them today. I put $3 worth of gas in the car, and I bought $17 worth of Doritos, Slim Jims, Kit Kat bars, Rolos, and Chocolate Turtles. And I proceeded to eat until I was about 700 pounds in 1986. And I didn't come up for air until 1986. And I came back to OA in 1986. And I heard some things and I saw some things that we're going to go into much greater detail in as the night and the weekend progress. I don't know what kind of time I have tomorrow, but tonight we're doing the doctor's opinion. But some of you are asleep. That's okay. When I used to sit in a chair, I used to sleep too. But the bottom line is that I heard some things and I saw some things in 1986 when I came back that I had never seen or that they meant nothing to me before. And the very first thing that I saw when I came back to Overeaters Anonymous was on page 58 of the big book of AA, is what I call step zero. And it says, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get there, then you are ready to take certain steps. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. What is it that we have? We have people losing weight. They have that at Weight Watchers. They have that at Tops. They have that at Nutrisystems, Metafast, the Bariatric Center. They have that at a lot of treatment centers too. What we have in Overeaters Anonymous is we had people in that room that were not compulsively overeating, and they were managing to do so happily. That they were not fighting food. And if you're here tonight and you're fighting food, then I'm going to invite you to join us in Overeaters Anonymous in working the steps. Because it says if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. I also saw something in the foreword to the second edition. In the foreword to the second edition of the big book of AA, I saw a startling thing. It said of 100 people who came into AA and worked the program, and that means out of this, not dieting with group support, calling in your food and making 3 outreach calls a day and calling your sponsor is not working the steps. They were working the steps out of this book. 50% of them got sober at once. And of the remaining 50, 25 came back and got sober. And of the remaining 25, they showed marked improvement. Now, I've been in OA meetings in Anchorage, Alaska, and I've been in OA meetings in Boca Raton, Florida, Mobile, Alabama, Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, Orange County, California, Los Angeles, California. I've been in OA meetings in Boston, Massachusetts. I've done big book retreats like the one I'm doing this weekend in about half the states of this nation. I've never seen 75% recovery. I've never seen 50% recovery. I've never seen 10% recovery. We're lucky if we are recovering in here at about 2, maybe 1.5 to 2%. What is the reason? Because we're getting away from this. Because we are obsessed with reinventing the wheel. With money-driven dribble that we hold in our hands and think that that's the answer. Or we're rampant with reinventing the wheel and dieting with group support. So if you want what we have, I'm going to have to do what these guys did who recovered that way, and I'm going to have to work the program out of here. I also read something, and that's the thesis line in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The thesis line is on page 45. It says the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And that's where I stopped right there, and I didn't want to hear about this God thing. Tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about the origin of step two. We're going to see where step two comes from. And we're going to talk about step two as the most underutilized step, and with 2 and 10 being the underutilized steps, 3 and 4 the most misunderstood. And I'm going to do the best I can this weekend to clear up steps 3 and 4. But we're going to talk a lot about step two this weekend. And we're going to see where it comes from. We're going to see where it originated from. And we're going to talk about it. Because I didn't want anything to do with a God who screwed me over. I didn't want to have anything to do with a God that made me grow up as a fat kid. I didn't want anything to do with a God that my father cried 10,000 times for what happened in his life. If you've never seen your father cry, I've seen my father bawl his eyes out 10,000 times. I've seen my father crying so uncontrollably. He couldn't stand. He couldn't walk. He couldn't sit in a chair. He had to be consoled for what happened in his life right before his eyes. No human being should have to go through what he went through. None. None. And when there'd be a holiday or he'd see people that were talking about God or anything, he would literally, poof, right on the floor, he would spit. I didn't spit on the floor here, but he would spit right on the floor. Why? Because he had some questions for God. And I bet some of you have questions for God. He had questions for God like, where were you? Why didn't you help us? Didn't you see what was going on? Why couldn't you come and help us? And I bet some of you have had those questions. And we're going to delve into that tomorrow morning when we do Bill's story. A lady in San Diego, California yelled at me one time. I did a one-day workshop down there. And I talk about Bill Wilson. If you came here, and I'm going to talk about Bill Wilson tomorrow. She didn't like that I was talking about Bill Wilson. I says, lady, I don't know any other way to present the material, but if you come up with something, I'm more than willing to listen, because we're going to talk about Bill tomorrow and we're going to see where step two comes from. And I saw people that understood. Now, before we break for our pee-pee break, I just want to tell you that I've been in OA for 35 years, since 1979, off and on, more on than off, much more on than off now. And I have 15 years of abstinence, and I've lost a little over 500 pounds. We're going to come back here in a couple minutes. Please don't take all night. I know some of you are going to drift away. I know some of you are tired. I can see it. It's late. It's 8:45 at night. I've had a long week too. If you come back, we're going to talk about the doctor's opinion. And we're going to see the nature of the problem. And we're going to try to dispel some of these things that we've been carrying around our whole life. Like, oh, I ate because I'm Greek. Or I ate because I'm Italian. Or I ate because I'm Chinese or Jewish. Or Catholic or Protestant. And we're going to smash down some of those myths, and we're going to get to the nitty gritty of what this is, and we're going to clear up what it isn't. Meet me back here in 5 minutes. I'm going to make pee-pee.